This recording is a service of the Allen County Public Library's audio reading service. It is specifically designed for and directed to people who have visual, physical, learning, or language challenges to reading traditional printed materials.
Welcome to Independent Living, bringing you thought-provoking news from a wide variety of medical newsletters and journals to help you in your quest to lead a healthy, happy, and productive life for years to come. It's all in Independent Living, coming up next on your audio reading service.
Welcome. This is Independent Living, and I'm your reader, Leslie, with the audio reading service at the Allen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Today I'll be reading from several health newsletters. The first one is from the Mayo Clinic Health Letter, copyright 2025, Mayo Foundation for Medical Education and Research. And this first article is titled Spinal Stenosis, Discomfort That Radiates. Paying for parking brings unexpected difficulty these days. When you fish in your pocket for spare change, you can't tell what's a quarter and what's a dime. Buttoning shirts also brings frustration as your fingers don't work like they used to. These motor skill issues come with occasional feelings of numbness and tingling in your back and down your arm and legs. All of these symptoms might be explained by spinal cord concerns related to a form of spinal stenosis. Cervical spinal stenosis occurs in the neck and affects about 5% of adults over 50 years old. It's a leading cause of spinal cord damage, also called myelopathy. A related condition called lumbar spinal stenosis is more common and occurs in the lower back. Whenever it occurs, spinal stenosis most often results from wear and tear over time. In fact, by age 50, most people have at least some signs of age-related deterioration in their spines. Sometimes these changes can put pressure on the spinal cord and nerves. For severe spinal stenosis, your healthcare team may recommend surgery. However, conservative non-surgical treatments typically are used first to help ease symptoms. Deterioration in the body's scaffolding. Your spine is the centerpiece of your back. In addition to supporting the weight of your upper body, it protects your spinal cord and nerves, which carry signals that control your body's movements and convey its sensations. The bones that make up your spine are called vertebrae. These bones are stacked on top one on top of another, creating a channel called the spinal canal. This canal surrounds your spinal cord. Other essential parts include muscles and ligaments that support and stabilize your spine, facet joints that help with movement, and discs that sit between the vertebrae to cushion the bones. Different conditions can reduce the amount of space within the spine, leading to spinal stenosis. The most common are age-related, and here's the list. The first one is osteoarthritis. With this form of arthritis, the cartilage that cushions the ends of bones in the joints wears away. When osteoarthritis occurs in the spine, the spaces between the vertebrae narrow, bone surfaces rub together, and facet joints and areas around the cartilage become inflamed and painful. This can lead to bony growths called bone spurs, which can narrow the spinal canal. The next one is disc degeneration. With age, the discs that act as cushions between your vertebrae can flatten and bulge. Eventually, the tough outer covering of the disc may develop tiny tears. This can cause the jelly-like substance in the disc's center to protrude and press on your spinal cord and nerve roots. And the next one is thickened ligaments. The tough cords that help hold the bones of your spine together can become stiff and thick. This can decrease the space between the spinal canal and irritate spinal nerves. Symptoms differ by location. The neck and lower back are the most common parts of the spine affected by spinal stenosis. Spinal stenosis in the neck can cause clumsiness and lack of fine movements, especially in the fingers. It can cause pain or stiffness in the neck or shoulder, as well as numbness, weakness, or tingling in a leg, foot, arm, or hand. It also can lead to imbalance when walking. When severe, it may affect nerves to the bladder or bowel and cause incontinence. Spinal stenosis in the lower spine, called lumbar spinal stenosis, is much more common, affecting up to 50% of people over age 50. There may or may not be any lower back pain, but you may feel pain or cramping in your legs, especially when you walk or stand for long periods of time. These sensations often are relieved by sitting down or walking slightly bent forward, such as with a shopping cart. Numbness or tingling in your legs or buttocks also may occur. Later on, weakness can develop in one or both legs. Some people may experience foot drop, a problem in which the foot slaps the ground while walking. Severe lumbar spinal stenosis also can cause changes in bowel and bladder function. Tests, symptoms, guide diagnosis. Symptoms of spinal stenosis may be noted when your healthcare team takes your medical history and conducts a physical exam. Other tests often are needed to confirm a diagnosis and rule out other conditions. These tests may include, 1, spinal x-rays. This type of imaging allows your care team to view bones and other bony structures in your body. X-rays can reveal bone spurs or other age-related changes in your vertebrae, as well as other issues such as fractures. 2, an MRI. An MRI often is the imaging test of choice for diagnosing spinal stenosis. An MRI uses a powerful magnet and radio waves to produce cross-sectional images of your spine that show the soft tissues. This can help reveal specifically where you have damage to your discs and ligaments and show places of pressure on your spinal cord or nerves. 3 is a CT scan. CT combines X-ray images taken from many different angles to produce detailed cross-sectional images of your body. With a CT myelogram, a CT scan takes place after a contrast dye is injected into your spinal column. This outlines your spinal cord and nerves and can show whether you have herniated discs, bone spurs, or tumors. And 4 is the EMG, and that's an electromyography. This diagnostic procedure tests the health of muscles and the nerve cells that control them, the motor neurons. And EMG results can reveal changes in muscle or nerve function or problems with nerve-to-muscle signal transmission. An EMG is used to check whether specific nerve roots are being compressed. It may show whether other conditions such as peripheral neuropathy are contributing to symptoms. So here are some first treatment options. Non-surgical treatment almost always is the first line of treatment for spinal stenosis, whether the stenosis is occurring in your neck or back. Your healthcare team likely will recommend one or more options, including 1, exercise and physical therapy. Exercises can be used to strengthen your abdominal and back muscles. Keeping active also helps maintain the flexibility and stability of your spine. Some physical therapy treatments, including heat and ice, may help ease pain and allow you to stay or become more active. And the next one is medications. Acetaminophen, like Tylenol and others, or non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs such as ibuprofen, Advil, Motrin, IB, and others, or naproxen sodium, such as Aleve, can help relieve the pain. Some studies have shown that certain antidepressants, such as amitriptyline or duloxetine, and anti-seizure drugs, such as gabapentin or Neurontin, or Lyrica, also may reduce pain associated with spinal stenosis. If conservative measures fail to ease pain that's severe enough to limit your daily living, your care team may recommend surgery. This is especially true if an MRI and your symptoms suggest that there's damage to the spinal cord. Surgery also is considered when complications develop. These include severe weakness or loss of bladder or bowel control. The purpose of surgery is to relieve pressure on your spinal cord or nerves. The most common procedure, called a laminectomy, removes the back portion or the lamina of one or more vertebrae to create more space within your spine. Sometimes vertebrae also may be fused to maintain the spine's strength. Most often, surgery helps reduce pain and improve function. However, if nerves were badly damaged before surgery, there may be remaining pain or numbness or sometimes no improvement. Surgery also comes with risks. The most common complication of spinal stenosis surgery is a tear in the membrane that covers the spinal cord. Infection and blood clots also can occur. The presence of other health issues can complicate surgery as well and affect whether you're a good candidate for a procedure. This next article is titled Lung Nodules. They're common and likely not cancerous. You have a CT scan of your chest. A spot is found on your lung. It sounds alarming, but it turns out that spots on the lungs, called pulmonary nodules or lung nodules, are quite common. They're found in up to half of adults who get a chest CT scan, and they aren't usually an indication of cancer. One study estimated that when nodules are found on imaging tests taken for a purpose other than lung cancer screening, only 5% turn out to be cancerous. Still, learning that you have something in your lung can be worrisome. Even when cancer has been ruled out, it's important to stick to a recommended follow-up schedule. Is it cause for concern? Lung nodules are areas of increased density in your lungs that tend to have a round shape. They are sometimes described as spots or shadows that show up on an imaging test. Most nodules are simply scar tissue from a past lung infection. They don't usually cause any symptoms. To determine whether your lung nodule is cause for concern, your care team considers factors such as these. Number one, the presence of a single nodule versus multiple nodules. Number two, the size of the nodule. Number three, how it looks on the scan, for example, its shape and density. Number four, your age. Number five, your smoking history, including how many packs a day you currently smoke or smoked in the past and for how long. Number six, whether you have a family history of lung cancer. And number seven, whether you have handled asbestos in the past. If you've had past chest x-rays or CT scans, your healthcare team may want to look at those to see if the nodule was present, and if so, whether it has grown. Avoiding unnecessary testing. Considering these factors, your care team determines what follow-up, if any, to recommend. If your nodule is smaller than 6 millimeters, just under a quarter of an inch, and you have never smoked, you likely won't need any additional testing. That's because the risk of such nodules being cancerous is so low. However, additional steps may be needed. If you smoke or have a history of smoking, in this case, your care team may recommend that you have a follow-up CT in 1 year. Or if your nodule is larger than 6 millimeters, or if you are at a higher risk of lung cancer, your care team may recommend that you have a repeat scan in several months to a year to see if the nodule has changed in size. In some situations, your care team might also recommend a positron emission tomography or PET CT scan to get additional information about the lung nodule. If the nodule doesn't grow over the course of 2 years, your team may determine that you don't need any further testing. But if the nodule becomes larger, biopsy or surgical removal may be recommended. In a biopsy, a piece of the nodule is removed and sent to a lab for testing to see if it's cancerous. Waiting months between scans can be stressful. It may be helpful to know that most lung cancers are slow-growing. The waiting process, a medical approach known as watchful waiting or active surveillance, aims to avoid unnecessary biopsies or surgery for nodules that are ultimately non-cancerous. If your nodule does turn out to be cancerous, a small nodular cancer is likely to be at an early stage when treatments are more likely to be successful. And here's a sidebar to this article. Used to smoke? Lung cancer screening may be recommended. A lung cancer diagnosis is not the dire news it once was. In its 2024 State of Lung Cancer Report, the American Lung Association noted that the survival rate has notably increased over the previous 5 years. While the overall 5-year survival rate for lung cancer is still relatively low at 28.4%, that figure increases to nearly 65% if the lung cancer is diagnosed before it has spread to another part of the body. Medical professionals have more and better options for treating lung cancer today. They also have better options for diagnosing lung cancer. Researchers continue to develop new treatments and advanced diagnostic tools. A key contributor to early detection, though, remains screening for people who are at high risk. The American Cancer Society recommends that you have a low-dose CT scan each year if you are between 50 and 80 years old and smoke or used to smoke, with a 20-pack year smoking history. For example, you smoked a pack of cigarettes a day for 20 years or 2 packs a day for 10 years. Getting screened regularly could be the key to finding lung cancer at an early stage when the chances are better for successful treatment. And moving on now to our next publication. This is the Tufts University Health and Nutrition Letter from the Friedman School of Nutrition Science and Policy. That's copyright 2025 Tufts University. And this first article is titled Electrolyte Drinks. Our bodies have a system to handle shifts in electrolyte levels. Is reaching for an electrolyte-enhanced beverage like electrolyte water or Gatorade a scientifically based choice or simply the result of savvy marketing? That depends on the situation. Electrolytes are minerals that carry an electric charge. The most prevalent electrolyte in the blood, sodium, plays a major role in regulating fluid balance and blood pressure. Other examples include potassium, which is essential for nerve conduction, and calcium, which is critical for muscle contraction, including the beating of the heart. The ins and outs. We lose electrolytes in bodily fluids, including sweat, urine, blood, vomit, and diarrhea. We get them from food and drink. Our bodies are remarkably adept at maintaining a stable balance of electrolytes through a process called homeostasis, says Daniel Weiner, MD, nephrologist, and director of dialysis services at Tufts Medical Center. The kidneys are the main player, excreting any excess electrolytes into the urine. Kidney disease, diabetes, and heart disease, and some medications prescribed to treat them, can interfere with the body's ability to regulate electrolyte levels. For example, some diuretics can cause potassium loss, while many medications used to treat heart disease can lead to potassium retention. Electrolyte drinks. Electrolyte-enhanced beverages aren't necessary in most cases, and the high sugar content in some can actually work against overall health. There are some exceptions. If you're doing really substantial activity when you're sweating a lot in a very hot environment, it may be helpful to replace electrolytes with an electrolyte drink, Dr. Weiner says. Think marathon running, endurance cycling, or manual labor in high heat. Electrolyte drinks may also be beneficial during a gastrointestinal illness, which can deplete key minerals quickly. Walking around outside or engaging in moderate physical activity, you're not going to lose enough electrolytes to need an electrolyte-enhanced beverage, says the doctor. The body may easily compensate with usual food and water intake alone. So before you reach for a sports drink or enhanced water, consider your activity level and overall health. A dietary pattern rich in fruits, vegetables, and whole and minimally processed foods, along with adequate water, is usually more than sufficient to maintain electrolyte health. For most of us, the best hydration strategy is also the simplest. Drink water, eat well, and trust your body to do the rest. And this next section is the News Bites column. The first little article, plant-based oils instead of butter associated with lower mortality. A large study found that higher reported butter intake was associated with higher risk of death, while higher intake of plant-based oils was associated with lower risk. The study followed over 221,000 U.S. adults for up to 33 years. Participants filled out validated food frequency questionnaires every 4 years. All participants were free of cancer, cardiovascular disease, diabetes, and neurodegenerative disease at the start of the study. Participants were categorized into quartiles based on their reported butter or plant-based oil intake. The highest butter intake was associated with a 15% higher risk of death compared to the lowest intake. In contrast, the highest intake of total plant-based oils from nuts, seeds, or fruits like avocados and olives was associated with a 16% lower total mortality compared to the lowest intake. Higher intakes of canola, soybean, and olive oils were particularly associated with lower mortality. The authors estimated that substituting 10 grams of butter, about 2 teaspoons, with an equivalent amount of plant-based oils a day was associated with a 17% lower total mortality rate. While all fats are a mix of different fatty acids, animal fats like butter, beef tallow, lard, and bacon, and tropical plant oils like coconut, palm, and palm kernel are highest in saturated fat acids, while fats from other plants like vegetable and seed oils are highest in unsaturated fatty acids. A dietary pattern higher in saturated or animal fat relative to unsaturated plant fat is associated with higher risk for cardiovascular disease. The authors concluded that substituting butter with plant-based oils, particularly olive, soybean, and canola oils, may confer substantial benefits for preventing premature deaths. And this next article in the News Bites, high-intensity interval training can help control type 2 diabetes. In type 2 diabetes, the glucose or blood sugar does not move into the cells as it normally would, so it builds up in the bloodstream, where it can have adverse effects on blood vessels and nerves. Physical activity encourages the transport of glucose into cells. In order to find out what kind of physical activity is best at improving blood sugar control, researchers conducted a review of results from multiple reports that pooled the data of original studies. This approach produced results with greater certainty. Data came from 10 systematic reviews with meta-analyses encompassing 76 primary studies with a total of 2,954 participants. The review found that people with type 2 diabetes who participated in high-intensity interval training, known as HIIT, H-I-I-T, had better blood sugar control than those who were sedentary or participated in moderate intensity continuous training. The high-intensity interval training was also effective at improving other important health measures like body composition, lipid profiles, blood pressure, and cardiorespiratory or aerobic fitness. Any type of physical activity is beneficial for blood sugar control and for overall health, whether you have type 2 diabetes or not. The high-intensity training involves alternating between short bursts of intense physical activity that really gets your heart pumping, typically 15 seconds to 4 minutes, and periods of rest or low-intensity exercise. This method can be applied to almost any activity that gets your heart rate up, including cycling, swimming, strength training, vigorous vacuuming, climbing stairs, or even walking and running, moving as fast as you can for a short burst, then slowing at a normal pace until your heart rate comes down, then repeating the process. If you would like to try the high intensity of training, check with your healthcare provider first to make sure that you have no contraindications. And this last news bite, breakfast cereals are not getting healthier. Ready-to-eat cereals are a popular breakfast choice in the U.S., especially among children. Researchers looked at the nutrient content of 1,200 new products marketed to children between January 1, 2010 and December 31st of 2023. During that time, sodium content went up by 32% and sugar content by 11%. Fiber content decreased over time. Additionally, the content of fat went up and protein went down, although these nutrients tend to be low in most breakfast cereals. While this study looked at only newly released products, it emphasizes that sweet cereals, which were never healthy breakfast choices for children or adults, are becoming even less healthful. For yourself and any little ones in your life, look for better cereal options made with whole grains and minimally sweetened, or try other options like yogurt with fruit, nut, or seed butter on whole grain toast, or hard-boiled egg and whole grain crackers for quick, easy breakfasts. Well, that's all the time we have for today. This has been Leslie with Independent Living, and I hope you've enjoyed today's reading from the Audio Reading Service at the Allen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana.